Hi. This episode, we begin discussing the New Stone Age.
The Neolithic.
Arguably the most consequential period of human development ever. In this period, we stopped hunting and gathering. We began to farm. So for us, we need to change things up. We don't have a single skeleton to discuss. Instead, we're going to talk about two collections of bones, both from early Neolithic tombs in southwest Britain, Wayland Smithy and West Kennet. We're going to use these tombs as a starting point to discuss a changing world, the introduction of farming, ancient religion, ancient violence, and stone penises. We'll ask, why did humans abandon the only way of life they'd ever known? How did that change not just what we ate, but how we thought? Today we make the first big stride towards modern civilization. Unsurprisingly, there's murder in this tale. I'm Andy Earnshaw, and welcome to Old Bones. Individual burials weren't really popular with Britain's first farmers. That's the first insight from today. If the Mesolithic was the last rich flash in the pan for hunter-gatherers, where food was plentiful enough to leave time for human expression, then the early Neolithic, the first nervous steps into agriculture, sees individual expression slip away to be replaced with a communal identity based around place and community. Nowhere is that more clear than in the tombs they built. Wayland Smithy and West Kennet are, for my money, the two greatest examples of early Neolithic long barrows. That's the term for any burial mounds you find in Britain. A barrow. The two major forms of barrows are long barrows from the Neolithic and round barrows from the Bronze Age. Obviously, the round form will be discussed in a few episodes. Neolithic long barrows, though, are made up of stone chambers and a long passageway covered in a very large mound of earth. West Kennet has five chambers, two on either side of the passageway and one at the end. Wayland Smithy has three chambers in a cruciform shape gathered towards the end of the passageway. Whilst these chambers were being used for burials, they weren't covered in large mounds, they were added later. The finished products, though, are huge. It's predicted that West Kennet's mound alone would have taken one person 16,000 hours to create. The mounds are usually slightly wider at the end where the tomb is, narrowing to around a point at the opposite end. All that earth comes from two ditches, dug either side of the mound. It's hard to tell how tall they were, as the earth they are made of has subsided over time. In my opinion, based on estimates that I've read and my own experience, they were probably around 4 meters high, or twice the height of a very tall man. They're not just tall. They're long too. West Kennet is 100 meters in length. The size of these things points to a more complicated society than one that had existed only 500 years before the tombs began to appear. The mound of West Kennet would have taken 20 people, a large group for the time, about 3 months of 8-hour days to create. Digging for 8 hours with picks made of antlers. That's hard work and a long time to spend not getting food. Therefore, the sheer scale of these tombs suggests at least a more stable society, and potentially one in which different groups helped each other to build these large monuments. The barrows are so huge that, sitting on top of the hills, they look like a secondary hilltop. But they wouldn't have been so hill-like when they were first made. The underlying geology at Wayland Smithy and West Kennet is chalk. That means that when the mounds were fresh, they'd have been bright white, clear and distinct in the landscape. If you want some idea of how white they'd have looked, then search for Uffington White Horse or the Cernabis Giants. Although, be aware that the Cernabis Giant is quite, talented. Both the Cernabis Giant and Uffington White Horse are thousands of years older than the Neolithic long barrows we're discussing today. But they show us just how visible a mound of Wessex chalk can be against the rich, darkly green grass of the region. As I mentioned earlier, these barrows aren't places built to honour a single person. Instead, there are usually multiple people buried at these sites. Wayland Smithy held at least 23 individuals buried at two separate stages. West Kennet had at least 47. Nor are most of these people interred with any respect to their own individuality. Usually their bones are separated and buried in different parts of the tombs. There'll be a chamber full of long bones, another full of skulls, etc., etc. Usually when people are buried, well, they're buried. They're put in their finest clothes, given a nice hole, all to themselves. Maybe they'll be left with some useful or attractive objects. This isn't just a modern Western thing. Most burials archaeologists find are in this state. Either that or they've been cremated, and again, when that happens, before they're set on fire, they're dressed up nicely and burnt with nice things. Maybe a particularly fat pig or a sword. That means that when we find them, they are, for want of a better word, in one piece. This isn't the case in the early Neolithic long barrows. One of two things is happening. One option is that when someone dies, the community decides that the tomb is short of leg bones, and so they take the deceased's right thigh and throw it in the tomb. The other option is that all humans in the Neolithic were disposed of in a way that disturbed their remains, and then those remnants were placed in a tomb. In many older cultures, especially ones who have a deep religious and spiritual connection to nature and place, there's a pretty interesting way of disposing with the dead. It's called excarnation. Essentially, it means leaving the body in an exposed place, often on top of mountains. There, the natural world, predators, scavengers, and bacteria will eat and decompose the body. Sometimes the body is left forever there. Other times it's collected and placed in a sacred site. We call that stage secondary burial. For my money, that's what's happening in the long barrows. The bones we find are often worn and sometimes show evidence of being nibbled on by wild beasts. I think it also makes sense psychologically for these people who are so reliant on the fertility of the natural world to want to give their bodies back to Mother Nature. After they've been left out, the early Neolithic people would then collect the bones. Maybe they would do this once they reached a desired degree of decomposition. Or perhaps they were collected during special times of the year. Either way, the bones are placed in the tombs. The burials in long barrows have been subject to some clever mathematics called Bayesian statistics. I'm not going to go into what that is right now, but it's enough to know that these burials have been studied very intensely. What that research has shown us is that the burials took place over a period of about 50 years. It seems that, for a very short time, every bone that was recovered from the excarnation process was buried in these tombs, and that then burial practices changed, or the tombs reached a desired number of burials, and then they stopped. We don't know what happened to the bodies of all the other people. I think they were excarnated, but with no secondary burial. But when the burials stop, the use of the tombs doesn't stop. We've already discussed that the mounds are built after the people have been deposited. There was other stuff happening too. We've got evidence of feasts by the entrance of the tombs. And within the tomb, there's the occasional bit of pottery or flint, sometimes animal bones or a polished hand axe. There's a lot of debates as to what exactly was happening with these tombs. Rather than set up an academic grudge match with lots of back and forth, let me share what I think was happening. But before I do that, if you would like to listen to the academic grudge match, get in touch. It'd make an awesome bonus episode. I believe that the chambers represent the dead of one small community, perhaps the first people to reach the area. They had brought a tradition of building large stone monuments with them from Europe. Evidence from the continent suggests that after 50 years, early Neolithic communities moved on, partly because their long wooden houses started to fall into disrepair after 50 years, but also because the methods of these first farmers were quite rudimentary. They didn't fertilise their soil, and so after 50 years, the land would be worn out and would probably take a few decades to return to fertility. A few decades after the community who built these tombs had left, new communities arrived to these newly fertile soils. One of the defining features of the Neolithic is an explosion in the human population, so there's probably multiple larger communities reusing areas once the land had recovered. I think I've explained plenty of times before how communities who may have been separated from other communities were still very aware of each other and definitely had closer relationships than we initially imagine. They were also aware of those who had come before them and of how important place was. This is even more true in the Neolithic. These were the first people to build truly permanent homes. They were spending a lot of time in a relatively small area. certain places became very significant. The stone tombs of the first farmers were built on hilltops, surrounded by highly fertile lands. Significant places indeed. This drew the larger populations to them. These stone chambers, filled with the first people to work the land, their ancestors, became central points for small separated farming communities to gather, to share knowledge and food, and also to find lovers. Many activities began to take place, some ceremonial and religious, some purely social. These new people decided to honour their ancestors by building them a house. The structure of the mounds is strikingly reminiscent of the Neolithic houses we have found. I believe these people were treating the tomb and its mound, made of bright white earth, the colour of clean bone, as a religious place which mirrored their own settlements. Isolated in place, but connected by ridgeways and river valleys to other communities. Some archaeologists have also said that their tombs look quite like the hand axes they were using, again reinforcing that link to the place and the act of turning the land from wilderness into productive fields, into homes. The people from the surrounding communities, those who worked together to create the mound, regularly met here. They feasted in front of the tombs. On some occasions, they brought the bones out and venerated them. At other times, they went into the tombs and left food and tools for their ancestors, so they could work the land in the other world. I think for communities coming after the first farmers, these tombs acted as the focal point for religion based on ancestors, important places, and fertility. The ancestors represented the first people to tame the land in that area. The feasting that we see was probably linked to both a thanking of the ancestors for providing a good amount of food, and also a cosmic bribe to ask the ancestors for help in the coming years. A bad harvest is probably the greatest terror to all pre-industrial societies. We see the concept of fertility in other more obvious ways. There is an article by a lady called Anne Tether, and I recommend you all read it. She's the first archaeologist to go through museum collections and point out they are chock full of Neolithic phalluses. That's right, carved stone penises. Some of them seem to have detachable testicles. They're between 4 inches and a foot in length. Some of these stone penises have been in these collections for hundreds of years without being identified as such. And I mean, only the most sexually repressed person could look at them and not see that they are quite obviously a Willy or John Thomas, a one-eyed trouser snake, a piece of pork, a wife's best friend, a Percy or a cock. But I don't think they're for pleasure. As we've discussed plenty of times, flint is quite sharp, and these have been created in a similar way to the hand axes we've been discussing. Some archaeologists have even tried to argue that they're specialised tools, which isn't incorrect, but not for the reasons they thought. I think these Stone Age penis carvings fit into the same psychological category as Venus figurines from the European Paleolithic and what Wikipedia politely calls sacred prostitution. They're deliberately sexual items, created to appear sexual to promote fertility. Again, the fertility of the land and people is the most pressing concern for a society who relies on agriculture and human labour to survive. However, like pretty much everything to do with the early Neolithic, we don't find these stone penises everywhere, in the same way that the tombs are never the same size nor really the same shape. The idea of initial communities creating tombs to serve for their dead speaks to the variety we see in the tombs. Unfortunately, it's hard to notice a nice clean culture arriving from long barrows. Whilst they all share the same core concepts, a stone chamber filled with separate bodies and covered in a large earthen mound, the details are usually drastically different. They vary massively in size. The stone tombs are very different in shape. The number of bodies varies, as does the state of their decomposition when buried. The gravegood assemblages are slightly different. The number of people buried, different. The level of separation of body parts between chambers, different. Nowhere is this difference more clearly seen than at Wayland Smithy. Whilst most long barrows have two stages, a stone burial chamber and an earthen mound, Wayland Smithy has an earlier phase. At this phase, there was a wooden tomb built. During this period, at one end of the tomb, was buried an individual, and scattered around him were 14 other individuals. Those 14 people had all the hallmarks of excarnated skeletons. The other person didn't. He was, as archaeologists say, articulated. a quote-unquote normal burial. Except that this isn't normal. It suggests social hierarchy where we have little other evidence for social hierarchy. It suggests that excarnation was a choice, not a cultural imperative. It muckies the waters. However, the wooden tomb rotted away. On top of it was built a more normal stone tomb, and then later on, the earthen mound. If we try and create a single homogenous culture, Wayland Smithy is a problem. It contradicts our argument. Now, if we see these initial burials as a farming community burying their dead in a way that is a variation on a cultural concept, Wayland Smithy is less of a problem. That person may have just been a particularly loved figure, and that the rest of the people were buried later, near to that very respected person. That individual burial doesn't need to be a king or priest, as has been suggested by earlier archaeologists. The weirdness of Wayland Smithy reinforces my arguments in two ways. The first is that these communities were separated from each other. Separate enough that they could take a cultural idea, the tomb and excarnated bodies, and change it to more closely reflect themselves and their beliefs. When people are separated, they diverge in everything, their food, clothes, and religious beliefs. In addition, the relative similarities between the tombs, even when built out of wood like Wayland Smithy's, suggest that these communities were separate but not entirely isolated. They were sharing ideas, they did have relationships with other people, in to which that they shared a general culture, but they were not so tightly bound as to feel they had to directly mimic other people. Wayland Smithy reinforces my argument in a second way. That's the importance of place. Almost every long burial had an initial short phase of a few decades. That is then followed by a much longer secondary phase of a few centuries. During that long second phase, people were still moving through the environments. The land still became regularly infertile, prompting them to move quite literally to pastures new. However, people seem to be keeping these long burials as a focal point around which to move. They keep coming back to them. It just so happens that Wayland Smithy, three different groups of people decided to work on the same tomb in three different ways, rather than two different ways, as is the usual case. The place is the thing. That's what's important. It's only when we see other changes to society in the late Neolithic that we begin to see an abandonment of the long burrows. And even then, later people kept these places as important sacred sites. We know then that these are complicated communities with a deep relationship to the land and particular places. We know they buried their dead and then venerated their ancestors with feasting. All good, but we don't know anything about the people who built these tombs. Not about how they lived. Stick with me. We're discovering that next. All that we have heard so far is a gargantuan departure from everything that had preceded the Neolithic. The first Homo, Homo habilis, appeared 2 million years ago. Every day since then, humans of all species had relied on a combination of hunting and gathering using stone tools. The specifics of the food we ate and the tools we used changed, but the essentials did not. 10,000 years ago, some people in the Middle East stopped doing that. They instead decided to focus entirely on ensuring that a few specific species grew when they wanted, where they wanted, and in the largest volumes possible. Humans stopped wandering through the world searching for food and shelter. They began to build permanent homes, changing wild beasts into biddable domesticated animals like cows, sheep, goats, and pigs. These animals were smaller, fluffier, fatter, and more chilled out versions of their wild ancestors. Humans turned wild crops into fat, distorted versions of themselves, pumped up full of sugars. You've probably already noticed that this has had an effect on their lifestyle, but let me reiterate what happened. The first thing is that the pace of change increased. Our first four episodes took long, confident strides through history. We covered 500,000 years of human evolution in less than 5 hours. Changes in our lifestyle were subtle variations on the hunter-gatherer theme, usually precipitated by changes in the environment. The rest of this series will be carefully working our way through 4,000 years of human existence. By moving towards a subsistence farming and pastoral mode of production, humans unlocked the stability and security upon which civilizations are built. The next thing is that humans stopped moving so much. Instead, they took to deforesting specific areas, building permanent houses nearby, and working the land they had cleared. Humans only moved from that small space when the land was worn out. This affected not just how we lived, but how we thought. There was now a much deeper connection to the place humans lived, and the pathways that connect these otherwise separated communities. Being human, we gave that deeper connection spiritual importance. Megalithic structures began to be built, as well as other large monuments, all focused on ridgeways and river valleys. The final thing that changed was the relationship we had with other people. Previously, humans came together rarely, probably only at times when there was such an abundance of food that a large population could be supported. Humans would grab at those times and use them as opportunities to connect with their wider kinship group, to discover new mates and to share knowledge. Any intercommunal violence that did take place was probably quite rare and due to a lack of opportunity as much as a lack of desire. That changed now. Humans began to develop the schizophrenic relationship with other communities that we are burdened with today. On one hand, we now had the stability to begin to build things worth trading. We're going to start to talk a lot more about trade. Unless you're some weird communal anarchist, trade is a positive interaction between communities. The aim is for both groups to get something useful and desirable from the other party. It can be the basis of friendship. It may have been that trade was tied up with religious festivals focused on the megalithic monuments like West Kennet and Wayland Smithy. Those coming together moments would have been useful for other things too, like finding new sexual partners. Presents, friends, sex, parties. All of this is sounding like quite the positive experience so far. In many ways, the relationship between communities in the early Neolithic is positive. There was a dark side though. The new obsession with place, the new sense of ownership of land, material and artifacts that was beginning to form led to increased competition. Competition not just for fertile land, which before effective fertilization was the most important commodity, but also competition for the richest land, the most sacred of places, the best people. The level of violence we see in the archaeological record explodes in the Neolithic, and the lust for the destruction of our fellow man only began to abate 70 or so years ago, when we got so good at killing each other that we threatened to end our entire species. How did all of this happen? Specifically, how did the Neolithic package cross the ocean and arrive in Britain? We're only starting to really get to grips with that question. There's a lot we still don't know. However, the theories break down into four categories. The first, a violent overthrow of existing populations by a more developed society. The second, that native populations adopted the new way of life, maybe due to interactions with other Neolithic people from the continent. The third option is that there was a small-scale, peaceful immigration from the continent, which slowly spread and outcompeted the Mesolithic people. The fourth and final one is that there was small-scale, peaceful immigration from the continent, which brought the Mesolithic people into their community, and there was an abandonment by the Mesolithic people in favour of the Neolithic approach. There's few areas in archaeology which reflect our current politics more than our answer to the question of how the Neolithic arrived in Britain. Back in the 1950s, in the dying days of the British Empire, archaeologists were very keen on the violent overthrow idea. It fitted their experience of going into seemingly savage environments, mowing down thousands of native people with machine guns and calling it progress. With the civil rights movement in the 1960s, the idea of a native people owning their own development became much more popular. With the advent of the neoliberal internationalist consensus in the 80s and 90s, people began to prefer the idea of competition. It's difficult but important to try and focus on what the data tells us. We already know from last episode that the Mesolithic society was complicated and advanced. They weren't ignorant savages. In fact, they were the pinnacle of pre-agricultural socio-economic development. Also, and this is important, being a hunter-gatherer is a more pleasant lifestyle than being a farmer. You have a more varied, healthier diet. You work around 6 hours a day, as compared with 8 to 12 hours for the average farmer. Those farmers have more diseases, higher child mortality, and more overuse injuries than hunter-gatherers. But it isn't all smiles and roses. Hunter-gatherers go hungry more often than farmers, and your population is limited by the wealth of the environment. Farmers experienced less drama, had bigger families, and had warmer, safer homes that helped them get through the cold British winters. But this isn't a better methodology imposing itself on a worse system. Nor is it proud native people fighting against the encroachment of some dark foreign power. The groups who arrived were too small and separated from each other to effectively work with enough coordination to conduct a planned invasion. The Neolithic cultures that arrive are also really varied. The monuments they were building in Kent were different to what they were building in Wiltshire, which is different from what they did in Cornwall, Yorkshire, and Scotland. This wasn't an invasion. Also, we know people from the two societies definitely got it on. There are people in Somerset directly related to Cheddar Man, the Mesolithic person we discussed previously. That means that in the area near to West Kennet and Wayland Smithy, Mesolithic people were either adopting to the Neolithic way of life or they were choosing to integrate very closely with the new immigrants. It's almost certain that sometimes the Neolithic people needed the Mesolithic people to survive. We have evidence of late Mesolithic cultures eating wheat, which they could only have got from Neolithic groups. That meant they were trading with them, potentially provided hunted meat, shellfish, or just knowledge of the local area. We also see Mesolithic culture influencing the Neolithic people. The cultural conversation wasn't just a one-way street. For example, take long barrows. By the time they were being built, caves had changed from places to live into places of burial, sacred sites. It's possible to view the dark stone tombs sitting alone atop hills as potentially artificial caves. It was only later humans who covered them with earth and turned them into central places of feasting. However, to see the arrival of the Neolithic people as purely positive is naive. Whilst we only have very few skeletons from this period, a few definitely show signs of violence. There's a Neolithic camp in Dorset at a place called Hambledon Hill. It was surrounded by a ditch. In one of those ditches was found the body of a young man, killed by a flint arrow. One explanation for this death and the existence of Neolithic camps like Hambledon Hill is that these were defensive sites. Neolithic peoples were building enclosures in which they could hide. These camps aren't everywhere, suggesting they weren't always needed. This suggests to me that sometimes the Mesolithic people were not entirely welcoming to the Neolithic farmers, and it was the farmers who were the ones who had to flee to safety. Because it's me, I think all four arguments for the Neolithic's version of the British invasion share a degree of truth, but that, in their distillation of the evidence to match the argument, they miss out a lot of vital nuances. In general, I believe that the Neolithic arrived in Britain via small-scale immigration. Whilst the relationship between the Mesolithic Brits and Neolithic Europeans did exist, I don't think it was close enough to inspire the adoption of a new way of life. They weren't trusted friends and partners. When small Neolithic groups from Europe started arriving, then their way of spreading and their relationship with the existing population depended on a variety of factors. For example, how fertile was the land? How big were the Neolithic bands that were arriving? How large was the native population? What was the experience of the Neolithic people in Europe? Had they been forced out by other groups, or did they arrive peacefully? What was the social structure of the different groups involved? Were they egalitarian or hierarchical? If they had a leader, what was their personality? All of these different factors and more influenced the relationships that existed between the Neolithic immigrants and the Mesolithic natives. Sometimes the land was big enough for the both of them, and over time, the Mesolithic groups chose to adopt the Neolithic approach. Other times, the land was no good for hunting and gathering, and the Neolithic people were unopposed. Sometimes the competition was fierce, and local genocide took place as aggressive Neolithic people murdered the existing populations. On the other hand, sometimes the Neolithic people came in peace, and it was the Mesolithic people who aggressively tried to force them out. The Neolithic peoples responded in kind. Finally, some groups established positive relationships with the Neolithic people, and they decided to help each other and created a new way of living which combined agriculture with hunting and gathering. In my humble opinion, this complex picture is a more satisfying and true narrative. It's mirrored in known examples of two socioeconomic systems meeting. For example, the very early colonists who arrived in the Americas. The stories of Europeans and Native Americans meeting are as varied as the number of times they met. Because the groups that were arriving were small and for the most part isolated, and because the groups they were meeting were very different from other groups, each meeting was different. It was influenced by the environment in which they met, the previous life experience, and the personalities involved. Whatever happened in each region, the results quickly converged on the same pattern over and over again. Britain became dominated by small-scale farming communities, some of which were focused on key sites like West Kennet and Wayland Smithy. The last question to answer for today then is, who were these people? We've already learnt some stuff about the people who built and were buried in the tombs of West Kennet and Wayland Smithy. We know they were creating homesteads which are habitable for 50 years or so. After that time, either the homes began to crumble or the land became infertile. We know that to create those homes, they had to chop down a lot of trees. We've also hinted quite heavily that those homes were long and quite rectangular, a little bit like the mounds they built over the tombs. We've spoken about how there was an odd mix of isolation from other people, but with the occasional coming together, probably at important religious sites like West Kennet and Wayland Smithy. Those meetings were probably quite celebratory, involving rituals inside the tombs and feasts near the entrances. We know that sometimes when those groups met, though, there was violence. We also know that they had a religion based around ancestors, fertility, and sacred places. But who were the people doing this? What were they eating and how were they getting their food? What tools were they using? How was their society structured? It's remarkable how little had changed since the first farmers had left Syria. The Neolithic package of rough handmade pottery, polished hand axes, domesticated cereals and animals sat at the core of how these people lived. Their lives were based around farming. There have been a few additions to the Neolithic package, mostly to cope with Europe's cooler climate. There was more of a focus on hardier grains than wheat. Whilst it did exist, people were usually eating rye and barley. Humans had also domesticated European boars, and so bacon had appeared on the menu, which is nice. There were exceptions to this rule, though. Some Neolithic people focused entirely on pastoralism. That means they were focused on managing large herds of animals instead of focusing on farming grains and having a few animals to provide meat and secondary resources like milk or wool. At first glance, pastoral communities contradict what I've been telling you. They practice something called transhumans. This means moving between summer pastures and winter pastures. So the permanent settlement I've been touting seems to fall under suspicion of not being true. In truth, the existence of pastoral communities reinforces the image I'm creating. Firstly, because it reinforces my argument that the Neolithic was a complicated picture, with each group taking a slightly different approach to survival. Secondly, because whilst pastoral communities move between places, those places are usually fixed. The word pastoral comes from the word pastures. They would have designated summer and winter pastures, and many pastoral communities build permanent shelters at those pastures, because they know they're going to be visiting them regularly. Therefore, even Neolithic communities that moved around limited themselves to a small number of places. Finally, I'd like to note that there's no reason why some communities couldn't combine both fixed-placed agriculture and an element of pastoralism. You don't need many people to look after a herd of cows or sheep. Pigs and goats practically look after themselves. The early Neolithic was complicated. Before we tie ourselves in pastoral knots completely, let's move on to food. It's during this period that humans in Europe and the Middle East evolved to be able to digest lactose into adulthood. That meant they could drink milk and eat cheese. And that tells us that using large domesticated mammals was a widespread phenomenon. Also, I know last episode I said the Mesolithic was a great time to be alive, and it was, but it was also completely without bacon, cheese, or grain alcohol like the whiskey I'm drinking right now. Yet another reminder that you can never have it all. The change we see in the human genome is also reflected in the archaeological record. The pottery of the Neolithic period is ugly, nor is it very practical. The Neolithic people hadn't yet learnt that you could make pots with flat bottoms. You couldn't put a Neolithic pot that was full of food on the floor. Ugly and impractical the pots may have been, but they were durable. more durable than the rest of their material culture. Pottery is one of the main Neolithic artifacts we have in a relative abundance. What is also durable is the residue that coated whatever these pots contained. That's especially hard to remove. Think of being the person who has to clean the gravy boat. Now imagine having to clean that without hot running water or fairy liquid.
Other detergents are available.
Pots got stained with what they contained. Bad for the Neolithic folks and good for archaeologists. We've sampled these residues and confirmed humans were cooking with animal milk. We're also pretty certain they were drinking beer. Not only that, but some researchers suggest that most of the Neolithic bread was made with malted grain. Malting grains, which means letting them sprout and develop their sugars further, makes grain softer and easier to process. You can add the malt to drinks to make Horlicks, or you can use it to make beer, or you can use it to make bread. The bread you get from malted grain is like a richer, sweeter version of an artisanal whole grain loaf. Except that in the Neolithic, you'd get the occasional bit of stone from the mill wheel used to crush the grains. Neolithic breakfast then was a bit like avocado toast, but with just a hint of danger. To summarise, the diet of the Neolithic people was based around sweet bread, weak beer, and milk-based products. They would supplant that with nuts and vegetables. Humans have always loved hazelnuts. They would occasionally also eat meat, especially when they feasted outside their tombs. Their usual source of that meat was from their domesticated animals, but sometimes they hunted deer and wild versions of their domesticated animals. For example, instead of pigs, you'd kill a boar. Instead of goats, well, goats. Goats have always just been their own animal. I respect them for that. Instead of cows, the humans would hunt aurochs, which are like cows, but huge and with horns that make a Highland cow feel emasculated. The people in these farming or pastoral communities are small, and they are, for the most part, alone. Some academics have suggested that they wanted to be alone. Indeed, their argument for the spread of the Neolithic peoples was that the more individualistic peoples chose to leave the complicated social structures forming in the Eastern Mediterranean at this time. They directly traced the more individualistic societies of modern Northwest Europe to these antisocial early farmers. They preferred the cold, dark forests of Germany, Britain, and Scandinavia to the fertile hills and warm weather of the Mediterranean coast. It's a nice idea, and reminds us that what happened in the Neolithic is affecting and influencing us today. However, to claim that this was the birth of Northern European culture is a stretch, even for me, the guy who thinks he can find the meaning of life in a Paleolithic thigh bone. What can we tell about these societies? Well, while very little is certain, I think most archaeologists would agree that the Neolithic was a relatively egalitarian society. There wasn't enough surplus food to support large groups with complicated hierarchies. Also, as we've mentioned multiple times already, they had a complicated relationship with each other. They feasted at tombs like West Kent and Wayland Smithy, and they also had to meet with other groups. See, people need sexual partners from outside their gene pool. Most people don't think like an 18th century European monarch. Whatever the spectrum of relationships was, some were deadly. We've already discussed one interpretation of sites like Hambledon Hill, where we see people being shot to death with bows and arrows. That may have been between Mesolithic and Neolithic groups, but it may just have been between two groups of pastoral farmers. The causeway camps I identified as defensive structures may be the rich summer pastures I mentioned earlier. Larger groups may have essentially fenced off the land to protect their livestock. Summertime may have been raiding time. Farming is hard, and it may be that when the world was less fertile, some groups turned to raids. It may also be that animals like cattle were a symbol of wealth. Countless cultures have associated the number of cattle you have with how important you are. When this happens, cattle rustling isn't too far behind. This brings us to a topic that reminds us of how our own opinions affect our view of the past. Did these people see violence as a good thing? I've tried to be honest about the violence that took place. However, I find myself coming to the topic cautiously, like I'm embarrassed or uncertain. I guess I want you to be as fascinated by these people as I am. Maybe I'm afraid that you won't if you see them simply as murderers who took a sick delight in the pain of other people. They definitely weren't murderers. Well, most of them weren't, so I can't speak for everyone. But to say they thought about violence in the same way we do is wrong. I doubt they saw it as something horrific like modern Western culture does. Instead, I think it's more likely that for many people, violence was a fact of life. Some people would have seen it as distasteful and unpleasant. Some would have reveled in the sheer thrill of it. Still others wouldn't have seen it as good or bad. Just a thing. Violence happened. In many pre-modern societies, violence is how justice comes about. Raiding, essentially armed robbery, is how wealth gets redistributed in the absence of tax. Whatever was happening, it's safe to say that the early Neolithic is a complicated and poorly understood period of history. We're on safe ground saying that the early Neolithic society was mostly small groups of farmers who sometimes practiced seasonal pastoralism. They were definitely more technologically advanced than any human before them. They made pottery, rapidly deforested the country, and took raw materials like barley and turned them into bread and beer. But when it comes to how they interacted with other people and how they thought about themselves, the picture gets complicated. We fall back on our own views of humanity. I happen to think of people as complicated things, capable of great violence as well as great love and joy. So I choose to see these people as disparate but connected. Sometimes those connections were positive, resulting in joyous feasts, moving religious ceremonies, and romantic self-discovery. Other times those connections were negative, resulting in theft and death. Sometimes they were a little bit of both. I've said it before, and I will say it again in the future. As we change the world, it changes us. The Neolithic Revolution was the first truly great spurt of human activity, resulting in wholesale world change. Trees were chopped down, foreign crops planted, tombs built. There was no way change on this scale wasn't going to affect the people doing the change. However, the explosion in evidence, the volume of data we get from this period is scary. No episode thus far has had as much research put into it, and honestly, I could have read twice or even thrice the number of articles, and I'd still have more to learn. When a data set is so vast, it's natural to look for the big themes, the big stories. It's important to structure the data, to create a narrative so that we can begin to comprehend what it is we are looking at. There are some big stories we can tell. The people who brought farming to Europe and then to Britain were immigrants who mostly replaced the Mesolithic populations. They developed a religion that was focused on ancestor worship and a deep relationship with the landscape. There was a Neolithic package, a repeatable set of plants, animals, and other products like beer, pottery, and polished hand axes that were used throughout Neolithic Europe. All that and more is observable when we look at the Neolithic. And it's a nice, easy story to tell. But this podcast isn't about finding nice and easy stories to tell. It's about peeling back the varnish on those easy stories and glancing at the mess behind. It's about trying to understand more about the experience of the people who make up this narrative we tell ourselves. When the story waters get muddied, the most fascinating things appear. Instead of a monotonous march of an advanced society sweeping away the existing peoples in the name of progress, the Neolithic was altogether more varied, more complex, and more interesting. As this new way of life provided more security, more calories, but also more people and more structure, small bands of people were moving away from a revolutionary epicenter somewhere near Syria. Nor were they always purely farmers. Some were farmers who often hunted. Others were people who were pastoralists, driving cattle and other animals around the landscape. However they lived, they moved into landscapes untouched by agriculture and created homes for themselves. This pattern happened over and over again, and the experience of every group was slightly different. Some met the Mesolithic people and simply ignored them, outcompeting them and forcing the existing populations to either die out or flee. Others met the native populations, showing them what they knew and brought those populations into their new society, marrying them, having children with them, children whose descendants still live in Britain today. Some of these small groups of early farmers met other small groups of early farmers. At that meeting, they sometimes traded, sometimes mated, and occasionally they fought, resulting in injuries and death. Every small group created a deep, unique relationship with the land they colonized. Often they expressed that in ways which were similar to their neighbors. In that sense, this was a true culture in the way we defined when we're discussing stone hand axes during the Upper Paleolithic in episode 2. But within that cultural trend, there were as many variations and adaptations as there were groups. They lived, died, and worshipped in ways particularly peculiar to themselves. They weren't like us. They died younger, ate worse food, and thought about themselves, their place in their world, and the nature of reality in radically different ways. They didn't see the world as a map, but probably as a set of deforested rings interconnected by valleys and ridgeways. To them, water wasn't just an everyday necessity, but a vital spiritual force that gave them everything from their daily bread to a connection with people beyond their homestead. Their politics were often based on expertise in a particular task, not some dreamt up social hierarchy where personal wealth is considered the same thing as your personal worth. However, in that patchwork quilt of different religious practices, schizophrenic relationships with neighbours, and an obsession with finding their place in the world, they are remarkably modern. That's because a lot of what we see are the foundations of our modern society. As we move forward, those things will often be disguised by pomp, splendour, and ritualisation. But they're always there, and I'll bring them out whenever I can. If you'd like to help me in that quest, please become part of my interconnected society on Facebook and Instagram. Searching Old Bones Podcast should help you find me. There are also reviews, the lifeblood of any podcast success. The more reviews I get, the better I get, and the happier I am. If you're feeling that you'd like to be part of my inner sanctum, my community, then there's Patreon. Details in the show notes, but again, searching Old Bones Podcast will get you there. Finally, if you'd simply like to keep listening to me talk at you, thank you very, very much for the privilege of doing so. Next week's episode, we go to Chile, Orkney, to discuss one of the most unique places the world has to offer. We're going to the heart of Neolithic Orkney. It's going to be great. I'm Andy Earnshaw, and this is Old Bones. See you soon.